Accession number 28685, Mr. George Mail, Real 5. Now, we're talking about when you were on HMS Heckler. Now, I sort of looked at some of the routine things. Now, what happened next then? I mean, what or any other stories from the time?
Well, I said about operations. That was my job, to look after the operating theatre and the surgeon. One day, the principal medical officer came to me and said, Mail, what do you like for hair cutting? He said, well, come on, have a go, cut my hair for me. We had a large pair of hair clippers and a small pair. And, of course, I'd got a razor, an open razor I always had to use for shaving. So he sat down and I trimmed his hair for him. When the young doc saw it, he said he wanted his cut. So I ended up cutting hair for about half a dozen people. I could have done a lot more, but I wasn't interested in making a thing of it. One of the interesting...
Did you charge him?
No. There's one in the... just see the chief wine steward and he'll fix you up with a drink. I was always able to get drinks from the wardroom if I wanted them. One of the things that happened aboard the Heckler was there was a lot of talk about that we're in Iceland, of course, and we're only getting mail infrequently when a ship happens to come up with some. But there was a lot of talk amongst the crew that letters were getting home without being sealed. Now, the routine was there was a post office, a post where you could post your letters unsealed. They would be picked up by the mail steward and he'd divide them up amongst the officers whose job it was to censor them and put the official stamp on and sign it and seal it then before they were put back in the post. But they obviously were skipping a lot. They probably put the stamp on, put their name on. I don't suppose they read half of them, but they didn't seal them. Now, there's such a thing in the Navy as KRs and AIs. That's King's Regulations and Admiralty Instructions. And part of that deals with mutiny. And mutiny is involved if sailors combine together for some purpose. So you had to be very careful not to be involved in that sort of problem. I was prepared to have a go. So every Friday morning at 10 o'clock aboard the ship, there was what is known as request men and defaulters. Well, very seldom was there a request man, but there would be defaulters every week, those who'd digressed in some way and had to be punished. I put in a request to see the captain, which would mean I have to go before him. I'd already written to my wife and asked her if she'd had this problem and if so to send me one of the envelopes that she'd received which hadn't been sealed. So I had got an envelope and it had gone through the process, but not been sealed. So I was prepared to go before the captain. Now, the last thing that they want aboard a ship is for the captain to get involved in anything. There was a lieutenant, an old retired chap who was still in the service, whose job was to be mail officer. And he stopped me and said, you're the person who has complained about the post not being sealed. Well, we've decided we're going to set up a committee amongst the crew, and as your name is Mail, it's appropriate that you'd be the first volunteer. I said, very, very thoughtful of you, but I want to see the captain. Next thing was, the surgeon, the executive commander aboard the ship, who was a very, what we would term a very pusser man, he'd stick to regulations. I had to go to him. I will see to this. You needn't bother about the captain. Thank you very much, sir, but I still want to go before captain's request men. I thought, I'm in it now. I might just as well pursue it. So the Friday morning, I had to go aft to the captain's request men and defaulters. There's the captain at the table, and arrayed behind him are all the officers who are not actively engaged on duty. There's the master at arms and the two regulating petty officers, and two sailors. These sailors, had, I don't know, they were late coming back off leave or something. They were each given 7 days confined to the ship, which didn't mean much because we didn't go ashore much anyway. And then the captain turned to the master at arms and said, Master at arms, I want all the lower deck people to be dismissed except yourself and Petty Officer Mayo. So the regulating POs and these two recalcitrants had to leave. And then he said, what is your problem? So I told him, have you any evidence of this? He said, I said, yes, I've got an envelope here for my wife. So I passed it to him, and it was quite clear the signature on it was Spring. It was a Lieutenant Spring. He passed it to the commander. Can you tell me what signature that is? No, sir, I can't make it out, he said. And it was passed from one officer to the other and back to the... Nobody would admit that they could read quite clearly that it was Spring. So the captain then turned to the master at arms and said, would you get on the tannoy Lieutenant Spring to come? So Lieutenant Spring turned up and he's added to the other officers. And then the captain said, this is a most serious matter. I don't suppose it applies to this petty officer only. It's probably a general thing that officers have not been doing their duty, which was after they've censored and stamped, to see that the letter is sealed. Now, he said, this I've always regarded as a happy ship, and I want it to remain that way. He said, but things like this can blow up, and I don't want this to happen. Thank you for bringing it to my attention. I'm sure this will not recur. I thought, yeah, that's all right, but Spring or somebody else will get me for certain. Nothing happened. It was all right. I didn't blow the noise about it at all, but the principal medical officer said to me, Mayo, it's not necessary for you or any of the staff to have your letters sent through the post box like that. Just leave them on my desk, and either myself or Steve, that's the surgeon lieutenant, we'll arrange your letters to be stamped and sealed, and then you can put them in the post box. So that was the end of that. But I felt I'd struck a blow for England.
Any other stories from that time? While you were at Iceland, I'm thinking of. I'm not sure how long you were there. You joined the ship, what, June?
12 months, nearly. We left in the spring of 42, about March. There were one or two things. There was a German submarine, the Graf, G-R-A-F, which had been sighted by an aircraft when it was on the surface. They bombed it, and it was unable to sink. So it was captured and brought into Valfjord. The crew, the officers and crew, were all taken prisoner, and we'd got this Graf submarine tied up with the rest of the ships alongside us. A number of our crew had to go aboard for various reasons. And after some days, the captain sent for the master at arms and said, "Master at arms, a lot of things have been removed from this submarine illegally. Brass plates and control knobs and so on." He said, "No, this is most important that this submarine will be taken back to the UK, reconditioned and put into service for the Navy." He said, "And without these things that have been removed, there could be all sorts of problems. What can we do?" "Leave it to me," said Master at Arms. So on the tannoy, he announced that his office would be open and he would not go into it from then until 5 o'clock the following afternoon. Anybody who's got anything, just even if it's a brass screw, will be able to put it in my office and nothing will be said. After 5 o'clock tomorrow, if anybody's caught with anything off that submarine, they'll be court-martialed. He said, "George, the following afternoon at 5 o'clock, I couldn't get into my bloody office. It was full of stuff from this submarine." There was a second story about that. I wish I'd got that tape of Greg Clark, the schoolmaster, because he'd told me when we met at Gosport 40-odd years later, that while we were in Iceland, he'd got very little to do as on the teaching side, so he'd been made cipher officer. And he said all these signals were coming from Admiralty and they were prefixed "hush hush graph." And he said this signal came, "hush hush graph. This submarine was known to be carrying a valuable Zeiss camera issued to U-boat commanders so that they could take necessary photographs. This camera to be forwarded to Admiralty forthwith." So Greg Clark said, you know, he thought, well, this is a matter for the captain. So he said, "I went after the captain's cabin." There he was. "Yes, schoolmaster. A signal from Admiralty, sir." And I handed it over. He read it. He said, "Yes, what do you want me to do?" "Well, instructions for reply, sir." He said, "Well, look on my mantelpiece. And there's this very camera." He said, "Make reply, no knowledge." Now, all the trouble that everybody else had got into, he knew if this camera went to Admiralty that somebody would get their hands on it. So that was Greg's story about the graph.
Now, any other incidents during this period? Anything else happened?
Well, while we were up there, the raid on the Lofoten Islands at Spitsbergen took place. Now, this was Norwegian property, but it was used by the Germans. Well, there was a fear that it might be. There were coal mines there, and I don't know what else, but anyway, it was decided that they would raid the Lofoten Islands and take off the inhabitants and wreck whatever establishments that were there so that the Germans couldn't get their hands on it. But when these ships came back from the Lofoten Islands, they came into Falfjord, and one of the merchant ships had got all sorts of... They were allowed to take whatever they could carry for themselves. But we had to treat a few of them. And when they came aboard, they would bring gift offerings. And I got all sorts of things from this Lofoten Island raid. The best was a £4 box of King Haakon chocolates. Great big box. And I thought, well, that would be very welcome at home. I'd also got cigarettes and tobaccos and a pipe. And there were skis that had been brought back from there. And various members of the crew got hold of a pair of skis. This was going to be good in the winter time, be able to go skiing in Iceland. then nothing was said about anything else, but over the tannoy they piped that skis had been taken off this ship, and that they disappeared from the boat. Obviously they were aboard the Hecla, and they said these skis will be wanted in Britain, they'll be given to the Royal Marines for their winter activities. So anybody who's found with skis aboard the ship will be in trouble. Well, of course, you could hide most things, but you couldn't hide a pair of skis. So all the skis were returned. And that was the thing about the Lofoten Islands. Nothing else of any great excitement, I feel, until March 1942, when we returned from Iceland back to the Clyde, Beardmore's Yard at Dumbarton, for a short refit.
So you were actually refitted at Dumbarton?
Yeah. And we got leave, we were able to go home, so I was able to take this box of King Haakon chocolates and various other things. We used to get, apart from our own ships, we had Canadian and United States destroyers and corvettes based on us. And if any of their crews came aboard, they needn't come for treatment, they needn't come empty-handed. They used to get butter in £1 tins, and sugar and tea and cigarettes, and particularly King Haakon cigars. And I would get these various things as presents. So I was pretty loaded down with stuff that was on ration at home. So I was very popular when I got back to Plymouth with all this stuff.
And what did you do on leave? Just,
well, only 7 days. The first night back, all the way down from Scotland down to Plymouth on the train, steam train, of course, took hours and hours and hours. I kept thinking to myself, now you be careful when you get home, otherwise you'll be saying something you regret. Now, I wasn't one to swear a lot. I used to think it was terrible. They would use the worst words you could think of just in conversation. They didn't mean a thing, but they used them. However, I thought I might be trapped into saying something. The first night home, my wife's father liked to go to the pub, and he never liked to go to leave until, as he termed it, it was time to leave. In other words, when they were closing. I could never drink more than 3 pints, but I'd had a night with him, and we came back. We were renting a bungalow at the time from friends, and there was my wife and her mother and her husband, my father-in-law, and it's about 11 o'clock at night, and in comes her oldest sister, Iris. And she's bubbling, she's full of life. George, I've given blood today. And now, this was fairly new in 1942. I've given blood today. I suppose you've given blood many times. Why should I give blood when there's 860 other bastards aboard the ship? I said, now, today that might not seem too bad, but then it was terrible to say that. So I'd let myself down right away. 7 days leave, back to the Hecla.
Still at Dumbarton.
Still at Dumbarton. We were only in there a couple of weeks, time for them to do various jobs about the ship and for us to have each watch to have 7 days leave. We then sailed. Convoys used to leave overnight. So we at dusk we went down the Clyde. And I can remember standing on the ship as we passed the Isle of Arran and the north coast of Ireland as it was getting dark. And then the next morning, I went up on the upper deck, and we were out of sight of land, and the whole of the sea, right to the horizon, was one huge mass of ships, including the home fleet, battleships, aircraft carriers, cruisers, destroyers, guarding this massive convoy.
Now, which convoy was it? Where was it going?
Well, we were going from, our first stop was Freetown. Each morning, for 4 days, the fleet, dressed overall, would come up through the centre of the convoy with the marine band playing and all the crew standing at attention. Quite a sight for 4 days. On the fifth morning, there wasn't one of them to be seen. They'd all gone into Gibraltar. A couple of weeks later, we arrive in Freetown. And my memory there was the day we arrived, on the way into Freetown, they'd sent out an aircraft with a drone, a drogue behind, for our crew to have practice at anti-aircraft gunning, because they'd had no practice. When the plane was in position, our guns opened up and puffs of smoke started to appear around the airplane. The next thing was, the plane had cut the drogue loose and it was off, it had gone. So we got rather a good reception when we got into Freetown, because the news of this had gone before us. We had a couple of runs ashore at Freetown.
What do you remember of it?
Oh, it was terrible.
What was terrible? In what way?
There was a beer canteen called King Tom Canteen, and outside there were a few natives who did various things. One of them could take a beer bottle between his knees, end to end, and with a piece of string around the middle, he would pull the string forward and back several times, obviously heating up the glass at that position. Then he'd open his legs suddenly, the bottle would drop into a bucket of water, and he'd pick up the neck of the bottle and the other part cut off cleanly. And you couldn't get glasses to drink out of. This was used then to drink your beer from. One of the other things was, one of the natives was there with bark off a tree, and you could sign your name on the bark, and in about 5 minutes he would trim off everything except your name, and you could use that then for marking your clothing. But boats used to come out, dugout canoes came alongside the ship, and some of them would have fruit, but most of them were just, they'd shout out, "Come on, Jack, what about the old Glasgow tanner?" They wanted you to throw money in the water so that they could dive in, and as it was going down through, you could see them underneath the water. They'd pick the coin up and come back onto their boat. Unfortunately, some of the crew started throwing washers. They were pretty ripe in what they said. When I went ashore, it was earth roads. There was no paving at all, and just huts around. And there was one big hut, which was a market. And just inside was an old native lady. And she beckoned me over. I went over, and she showed me a page from the London Illustrated magazine. "You know this lady?" It was Queen Victoria. So I said, "Yes, that's Queen Victoria." "Ah, Jack, you have a very retentive memory," she said. this was an introduction to try and get you to buy some of her wares. I was set upon by a little group of youths who tried to persuade us that they would carry us across a stream. Well, the stream was only a couple of inches deep. We didn't need to be picked up and carried across. So we pushed them away. When we got to the other side, they'd pushed around us before we got rid of them. When we got to the other side, you found that your pockets had all been gone through, not to your knowledge. I had, of my money, I'd got in my money belt, and they hadn't got in there. I hadn't got much money anyway. But in my top pocket, I'd got a leather folder, which looked like a wallet. But what it was really was a picture of my wife that would fold over and open up. And that had gone. And then one of these kids came over to me with this in his hand, with dripping wet. "Ah, Jack, you dropped this in the water." So I did get it back. On one of the visits ashore, we went to buy lorry, open-back lorry. They would take as many as they could carry, a few miles to a place called Lumley Beach, which was a real tropical paradise. Banana trees at the back and lovely sand. And that was an enjoyable little visit. So that was Freetown. When we left Freetown, our next port of call, we'd still got some destroyers and corvettes escorting this great convoy. We hadn't lost any ships. We were lucky. When we got off Cape Town, half the convoy went in there to give. We'd been at sea now for a month, other than a short visit in Freetown. What was I saying?
You're talking about your arrival at
Cape Town. Yeah. Half the fleet went in there to give the lads a break ashore. And we were then in charge of the rest of the convoy. And we went around. We left the Clyde at the 15th of April. On the 15th of May, we were off Cape of Gullis, Cape of Good Hope, 90 miles out at sea. It was a lovely afternoon. I'd had tea and I was on the well deck when suddenly there was a terrific bang and up came flames and smoke, and they didn't know what had happened. They thought we'd been torpedoed, but in fact we'd struck a mine. And at the same time, one of the merchant ships with us had also been mined, and that one was carrying a complete hospital for the troops in North Africa, and it sank in 10 minutes. Now, we didn't sink because we were a brand new ship, and we'd got a 5-inch armoured steel middle deck, and that was buckled and split, 5 inches of armoured steel. But it saved my ship from breaking its back.
Now, this was off Cape Town then?
Off Cape of Good Hope.
And what was the actual date the mine went off?
15th of May.
And what was it like on board ship for you when you hit the mine? What do you remember of it?
Well, as I said, I was on the upper deck, and there was smoke and flames, and most of the crew, if they weren't on duty, were in the mess decks above the point where this problem was. And the decks had buckled and the stanchions had been bent. And sailors came stumbling up from the mess decks up into the open air. And they'd suffered from smoke inhalation, and some had got injuries.